Another question that was raised was this, what was mentioned was the being asked why you read spiritual books and meditated and paid attention to spiritual matters, and your response being, well, sometimes life is so intolerably miserable, or you're suffering so much that you feel you've got to do something, and this is what you do to come back to yourself or to remember yourself. And you thought that was a rather depressing motivation for attending to spiritual matters. Well, one thing I can say about that is that you're not alone. Even 2,500 years ago, the Buddha was talking about different motivations for seeking the way, and there are some people who, believe it or not, actually seek a path of practice because they're so happy that they go inquiring into the path for liberation. And I can't relate to that myself, but the Buddha said there are such people. His right-hand man, Sariputta, was such a person, and you know, just a few words, a few sentences, and you know, he was blissed out, you know, and within no time at all, the whole thing was settled, and he was free. His left-hand man, Venerable Moggallana, it took him several days before he settled the matter, and his path of practice was referred to as a path of practice characterized by suffering, or dukkha patipatti vimutti, you know, liberation realized through an inquiry into suffering. The other one is sukha patipatti vimutti, liberation arrived at through an inquiry into or associated with lots of pleasure. So you know, you're not alone, and there's no reason why, from the Buddhist perspective, anyway, you should consider it as any sort of invalid motivation. If you find it a depressing motivation, well, I would suggest looking at the assumptions you have about these things. That you know, surely what matters is that we do feel there is a place within ourselves that we can go to. And there are external resources that help take us there. Personally, I don't have a very well-developed relationship with books, but to me, people are much better. I find people as a marvelous trigger, and always have done, that just to have a discussion with somebody when you've lost perspective, when I've lost perspective, and to have a discussion with somebody about having lost perspective, but when that somebody actually knows how to really listen and is not got an opinion about losing or finding perspective, they just share the interest in reality that one is looking for. And so for me, such a resource has always been a great and precious asset, if I can use that word, to remind me or take me back to where I really need to be, which is balanced, seeing things in perspective and remembering not to get lost in the experiences that I'm having. But whatever it is, whether it's people or books, tapes, reflections, these outer resources, if we engage them and they remind us of another dimension, then surely that's all that matters. You know, the struggle so often is the case that we forget that there's many dimensions to experience, there's many dimensions to our lives, and we think the fact that we're having a bad time or we're feeling disappointed or sad or betrayed or lost confused, and all we can see is failure. All we can feel is failure. And all the voices we have in our heads are, you know, you deserve it anyway because you're so weak. You were just kidding yourself anyway and kidding other people. You know, putting up this front of being interested in spirituality or being together. You know. Our minds get possessed with such thoughts. Our hearts are full of the same feeling of sadness. And there can be a perception of it's just going to always be this way. That's something to do with the concept that people have of eternal hell. When the heart contracts and the mind narrows and we get stuck like an old record just going round and round in the same groove. It just gets caught and doesn't move on, just gets stuck and goes round and round. When we get into that state, there is the perception of it's always going to be this way. Now, we don't have that feeling when you're sunning yourself on the rocks, you know, on a gorgeous early autumn splendid day, you know, as wonderful as this country can be at this time of year when the sun is shining and your health is good and the company is good, and you're not lost in, you know, the perception that it's always going to be absolutely marvelous. You know, there's a certain sense of, well, it's nice while it lasts, but we know, you know, it's a, you know. But when we get caught in negativity, there can be a sense of it's always going to be this. I've never known anything else. I was just kidding myself. On this level, I've always been a slob, and I always feel I'm going to be this way. And that's the delusion. That's the con. And in the beginning of our spiritual effort, we don't know that it's a con. It's like any other con in life, you know, the con of, you know, certain salesmen, you know, the first time you buy a car or you know, you're doing some housework and, you know, you look up in the yellow pages and you get conned by some cowboy carpenter and the first time you do that, well, you know, okay, I was conned. The thing is not to get too heavy on ourselves, you know, just say, okay, well, I won't do that again. And that's very much the case with our inner work, that we get conned, we get fooled into thinking that this perception of it's always going to be this way actually is like that, and we lose contact with that precious sense of doubt that really is the other side of faith. We so often think that faith is, you know, radiant and wonderful and always believing in something good. That's not the case at all. You know, the other side of faith, the back of faith, if you like, it's just, we've got a front and back of the hand. Faith has got a back as well. It's doubt, and they go together, and there's a force there. The great doubt that undermines the assumptions we have about reality. We lose touch with that great doubt, that precious doubt, as well as, of course, we've obviously lost touch with the radiance of faith. And we just assume the way it appears is real. You know, it stinks, basically. Life stinks, I stink. And so, you know, I don't see that as a depressing myself. I don't see that as a depressing motivation. I don't really care what the motivation is myself. Whatever the motivation, to actually pick up something that reminds us, this is only one perspective. This is a limited perspective. Perfectly valid. Every perspective is perfectly valid. Even a miserable, depressed perspective is perfectly valid. It's still a miserable, depressed perspective. But it's a valid, miserable, depressed perspective. But what's so important is we remember it's only one perspective. And there are other perspectives. And so to pick up a book that reminds us, or to listen to a tape that reminds us, or to meet somebody for a conversation, it reminds us, you know, this is relative. This is not an ultimate reality. It really, really does feel this way. As I've said so many times before, the image that works so well for me is a mirage when you're crossing a desert. And as I don't know whether any of you have done, but I have in Australia, you can be out in the desert and you can see a mirage, and it really, really looks like water. And you really, really feel thirsty. There's no question about the experience of being thirsty. There's no question about the apparent nature of what you can see there looking like water. The uninformed response to that is, you know, you feel convinced that your thirst is going to be quenched in a minute, and the natural consequence is huge disappointment. It's an apparent reality. It's created by illusion of light on reflecting on the sand. Well, so it is with the apparent reality of our depressed, miserable state, that whatever the stimulus, and there's certainly plenty of stimulus around that can make us feel miserable.
I think I failed to articulate was the sense that no matter how many times one reaches for the salvation of the book, the conversation, or the meditative technique, and finds a moment of respite, that inevitably at some point, you know, I'll go back into the place of not knowing.
You'll go back into the...
Go back into the pit or whatever. The pit may be temporary, but I'm going to go back there.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, and that's why the skill is agility of attention, not which realm you happen to be passing through. Yeah, that's why in the meditation I said it's the awareness that's the point, not what's passing through the awareness. And no judgment in the fact that we lose that appreciation. No judgment in that at all. Or if there is judgment, then, you know, what is so important is that we see the judging as it's happening. Yeah. If when we fall into hell, as has happened so many times and as will happen still, if we can, when we're in hell, if we can quietly on our own see if we can not just hear the thought, although that might be the indicator, but feel the feeling of being judged for being in hell, as if somebody condemned us and put us there. Yeah, I deserve this, or I'm a failure because I'm here. Well, this is the place I should be, and I always will be here. Whatever the noises might be. And they can be really, really sick. But if we can be there for them and really consider the way we relate to them, as soon as I know the first time I started noticing how compulsively judging my mind was, what I was aware of was that I was very judgmental of this compulsive tendency. Yeah, I was so caught in the game. I shouldn't be doing this. I shouldn't be judging this. I still have accurate memory of the deepest pit of hell that I've ever been into, and I can remember the observing this tendency to judge it. Yeah. I'm a failure for being here. And the feeling of that, not just the idea of it, the idea is an indicator, but the feeling of it, I've failed, I'm wrong, because I'm suffering so badly. But to somehow be interested in the relationship with that experience. And that's why the Buddha went over and over and over and over and over and over again about mindfulness as the way. Mindfulness, not what we're being mindful, but mindfulness itself, awareness itself, is the way. The quality of non-judgmental here and now awareness, if we work on this, if this is what we work on, in the moment, here and now, in this moment, here and now, really consciously appreciating the power of here and now judgment-free awareness, then when the suffering arises, or when we find ourselves in the pit of suffering, there's a chance we'll remember. Sooner or later it will happen. Sooner or later, even when we're in hell, and there's this judging is going on, we'll remember what we're talking about now. And there'll be the, I trust, because I know you're interested, there'll be the, instead of the being caught in the game of saying I shouldn't be judging, there'll just be an interest in, say, judging. And as soon as we see it, that's it. As soon as we see it, then we're not possessed by it. As soon as we feel it, as it is, as it's happening, then we're not defined by it. And even if it's only a little shift in increased capacity to receive the present moment, it'll count. And then we'll remember again the radiance of faith. We may not spring out of hell, but the radiance of faith will support us in hell. And the other side of the faith, which I mentioned a minute ago, the doubt, will be strengthened. I say, oh yeah, it really does appear this way, but maybe it's not like this. It really does appear like I'm damned, eternally damned. It really, really feels like that. But there'll be another dimension. And I'll be saying, well, yeah, it does really appear like that, but the last time I saw that mirage and I ran after it thinking I was going to get my thirst quenched, it just didn't work. And there'll be that knowledge, that wisdom will be there, born out of having investigated, having born with the suffering, with here and now judgment-free awareness. So, I don't know, you know, I don't think about when transmigrating through the various realms of heaven and hell and everything in between, when it's going to end. I don't dwell on such thoughts, but what I do dwell on is how can I be more agile? How can I flow through these more? Not, don't try to go to heaven. You know, there's great Buddhist stories about heaven. You know, you can get born in heaven according to the Buddhist teachings. And I don't know, you've probably been there for eons. But look what happened. You came back again. And one of the things that they say about, you know, angels in heaven, when angels are about, this is quite funny, when angels are about to descend, because you can be up there for eons, according to Buddhist mythology. When you're about to descend to go down to a human realm or an animal realm, I don't know whether you can take a direct trip down to hell from heaven, I don't think so. But anyway, you can descend to a human or animal realm. What starts to happen is you develop body odour. And the other celestial beings, they just distance themselves from you. Because most celestial beings, so long as they're kind of really going through their angel thing, they don't have any body odour. They're just lovely. And but then once the body, once you know your time, your good karma's wearing out, basically, you know, you're getting ready to go down, you develop body odour. And it's a sign. And you've got to go down again. So that's what happens if you go to heaven. I mean, eventually you'll come down again. In most cases. I mean, there are a few apparently rare cases where you just go out. But I wouldn't dwell on that. So. And there was another comment from James that to say something a little bit more. I mean, I feel like I'm, you know, if I heard your question or your comment, James, I feel like you know, we're talking about what you're talking about, which is that attending to reality is so nourishing of a place that actually sustains us in a way that matters much more than anything else. You know, we don't have conversations like this every day with people who share something as we share. I don't, anyway. You might think I do because I live in a monastery. You might think that, you know, we talk about real matters all the time. We don't. You know, right now we're talking about, you know, whether we're going to have porcelain or plastic or ceramic lights in the new retreat house. Yeah, it's not this quality of discussion. And it actually is not as important as this. It's got its place. But this matters much more. You know, it really doesn't matter whether you have plastic or porcelain or ceramic or metal lighting. Not ultimately. I mean, I do get excited about it and I do feel enthusiastic about it, and I'm pleased Anna gave me a nice contact in Edinburgh to go and look at the lighting shop, which Jim and I are going to tomorrow. But that doesn't really matter. And I know I've talked about this many times before, but I feel it is worth saying again that it's important if we consider for ourselves, so that we know for ourselves what are my important matters and what do I do that addresses them. Because as James was saying, you know, some of you were up at Glen Lyon a couple of weeks ago sitting silently together, and I don't know if you were silent all week or whether you had some discussion as well, but the quality of community that I imagine you're referring to has got a certain relevance to it, that when we see it contrasted up against a lot of the rest of our life, I think one can say it's precious. And that's why, you know, Buddhists talk about the three gems, the three jewels, Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. They're called jewels because they're precious. The Buddha is precious to us as a teacher, as a manifestation, as as an actual human being who lived in this world and realized for themselves this freedom from any obstruction to relationship with anything. The Buddha realized the state of perfect, unobstructed relationship with everything, and it wasn't a realization that he could regress from. And that is a possibility, is an inspiration, it's something that is precious, that we can work towards, can inspire and uplift us. And the Dhamma is precious, both in the sense of the Dhamma as teachings that we were just talking about, supports, guides, friends, teachings, books that help guide us, even guide us towards actually a more accurate receptivity of that which is utterly intolerable. As Master Shun Hua said, our practice is to endure the unendurable. How do we endure the unendurable? How do we do that? How do we endure the unendurable? That's the question. And Master Hua is one of the great meditation teachers of this era. That was his message. That's what we have to learn, how to endure the unendurable. And what we do when you endure the unendurable is we realize there's a deeper perspective. There's another perspective on that which was apparently unendurable. But on the level that we're at, it appears unendurable, and we've got to endure it. We've got to meet it with endurance. And how do we do that? Dhamma helps us do that. Whether it's Dhamma friends or Dhamma occasions or Dhamma conversations or Dhamma books or Dhamma born out of silence, Dhamma is what takes us to the capacity to endure the unendurable, where we remember, reconnect with another perspective which shows us this is not an ultimate condition. Dhamma is precious and Sangha is precious. Sangha, certainly the principle of spiritual community, where there is a communing, there is a coming together, there is a resonance of human beings. The Buddha, as I've said, has a relevance to us. The Dhamma has a relevance to us. The relevance of Sangha, it seems to me, is the perception that we're not alone in this. When we're suffering, or if we're, whether our suffering is gross and we feel deeply threatened, deeply alone and unable, or whether it's a subtle form of suffering where we're in touch with the heart's quiet but focused longing to know what's true. That's not a gross, agonizing suffering, but there is a deep and meaningful, deep and significant pain in that. And so whatever our human experience may be of being limited in our lives, to have the appreciation that we're not alone in that is very, very important. And that's, for me, a profoundly important aspect of the preciousness of Sangha, of actually being together with people, others who share this recognition of relevance. And I know the word is overused these days a lot, but you know, the nourishment that can be experienced, whether in silence, whether in dialogue with others, I don't think there's any substitute for it. Yeah. In the Christian tradition, is, you know, it says, "Where two or three are gathered together in my name, I am there." You know, if we see beyond the conventional understanding of that and consider that the speaker of that is a symbol for compassion, selflessness, compassionate love, where two or three are gathered together in selflessness, yeah. Where two or three, where there's a group, where we actually meet beyond personality, beyond the level of, you know, gossip and chatting and me promoting myself and, you know, and comparing myself to you and you promoting or comparing yourself to me, and you know, beyond that level, which certainly is superficial, beyond that, if we meet, yeah. When two or three are gathered together in my name, I am there. And there's a force, there's a resonance, it's struck up, which is above and beyond the significance of the two or the more or the gathering. And I often remember in music, again an image which you've heard me mention before, you strike two notes, and if it's the right two notes, there's a harmonic. That harmonic, you know, what is it? It's not the same as those two notes, but it's not independent from those two notes. Yeah. Or it's the same when, you know, when a couple come together in love and a child is born. That child is not separate, but it is separate. And it's an expression of a union. And yet it's greater than the individuals. And so it is with spiritual community. If we can find our way, our ways, and each of us find our own ways to grapple and deal with and meet and ultimately hopefully receive our obsessions with individuality and see beyond ourself, find a way beyond our commitment to self, me and my way, and we can meet in that place, then we commune. We come together in spirit, and there's something profoundly precious about that. I find there's a pleasure, there's an actual physical pleasure in that, a bodily feeling of pleasure to be in such a way of being together. And there's also there's also an intelligence which can even be intoxicating, I find, is in that if there is such a resonance, if there is such a meeting of hearts, of being, there's an understanding that starts to emerge. And I know we had a retreat, you know, many of you were on retreat in August at the monastery, and for me it was just it was such a lovely time. I look back at the summer, and that was the highlight of the summer, that week when 18 of you were together. And it wasn't because I was doing such good meditations, not at all. But it was because I believe, I have no empirical proof of this, but my conviction is it's because we were together in a place that was beyond ourselves. And that's, again, is understanding can come, is born out of that sort of meeting, that spiritual community. And so, those are my reflections on why it is so so precious to be able to come together in such a way. So thank you very much for your attention this evening.